Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to An Hour of Mind Power. Donna Sebo here, and we're going to be talking about a subject I know all of you have experienced at one time or another in your life, and that is dealing with difficult people. My guest, Lisette Larkins, has a unique approach that I think you can utilize. It caused a lot of thought in my mind, and I think it will in yours as well. Lisette, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Now, your book is Difficult People, A Gateway to Enlightenment. And I have to chuckle because when you think of difficult people, I'm sure just in everybody's mind, just like in mine, we can bring up instantaneously those memory banks of stinky personalities that we just as soon would never have to cope with. But we all do it one time or another. Now, you have had a particular experience that promoted your putting this book together. But before you go into that, I'd like my listeners to know that you have published 3 books about paranormal experiences. But what put this on the table, dealing with difficult people, was the fact that you decided that you wanted to take a job as a caretaker. Tell us how that came about.
I had the internal guidance to leave. I was at one time a sales director for Hampton Roads Publishing Company.
Mm-hmm.
I just got internal guidance to just leave that, and I didn't know what the next step was for me. I just knew that I wanted to grow spiritually speaking. That was my goal. I would have considered myself to have been a well-read spiritual practitioner, but I noticed that, gosh, you know, there were lots of really wonderful days, but the mental suffering still bubbled up. And knowing what I knew about spiritual gains, those so-called bad days were supposed to be diminishing, not increasing. And so I really was very prayerful. I wanted to find a spiritual teacher, the best on the planet. And if that meant moving to an ashram in India or moving someplace in the desert where I could find somebody who could show me the way to find that seemingly elusive state of chronic well-being, I wanted to sign up for it. So okay. Along came this woman who was at the time 68 years old in late stage Alzheimer's, and her husband was looking for a caretaker for her, or caregiver, I should say.
Lisette, I need to stop you for just a minute. I hate to interrupt you, but your voice is coming through. I think we may need to call you back because your voice is coming through gurgling. Are you on a cell phone?
No.
Okay. Your voice is cutting out so badly. I don't want my listeners to miss any of this, and I'm sure if I'm hearing it. And my engineer, Seth. Seth, can you come in for a minute? I don't know where Seth is. Okay, now you cleared. Now you cleared. Now you're not gurgling. I'm sorry I interrupted you, but your voice was gurgling a lot, so I wanted you to not have that. So let's go on. Excuse me for interrupting because it sounds like it's cleared. Okay,
I took a job as a caregiver for a woman with Alzheimer's. I had no training, no experience, no real reason to take the job other than I had been praying for the right next project for myself. I wanted a spiritual teacher, and my dreams, my intuition said, go here. So I did, and the way that it turned out is this woman who was in late-stage Alzheimer's, resistant, angry, at times very aggressive, furious at her situation in life. She was stunningly beautiful, very athletic, competitive golfer, very, very smart, in command of her life, got Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came on the scene, she didn't want me in her house. But her husband and family had hired me, and there I was. And it turned out, guess who was my next spiritual teacher?
Yes, the delightful, gorgeous lady.
Yes. So we started on an adventure together. I didn't have any idea when I started what an adventure it would be. And so for the next 3 years, I was her full-time live-in caregiver, and it was extraordinary because, like anybody who knows anything about the onslaught of Alzheimer's, basically the body just starts shutting down one area at a time, and mm-hmm. eventually she lost the ability to walk, talk, eat, and, of course, know the people around her. So it was very, very challenging. But early on, I had to make a decision. I was reactive to her, not externally, but internally. So mm-hmm. when she would go crazy because of some very small thing, like we'd be driving along and we would go out in the day and I would take her for outings. And let's just say there was a garbage truck in the middle of the road. And she would become angry and resistant. And in essence, I started to notice that she just, no matter what was happening, she didn't like it. She wanted to get out of this moment and into the next one, even when the next one wasn't any better than the one that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I started to notice was, what I started to ask myself was, gee, do I do this too? I mean, okay, maybe it's to a lesser degree, but is there some aspect of me in which those same mechanisms are alive and functioning inside of me? And so I started to pay attention to that. I got a stopwatch that went off every 9 minutes, and every time it would sound, I would notice what I was thinking. And sure enough, just like she demonstrated, my thoughts were either on the past, either regretting, comparing, contrasting the past, or hoping to get to the future. And that was exactly how I would characterize her own mental state. She had absolutely no tolerance for this moment right now. She could not find any peace. There was no way to satisfy her. And in fact, I noticed that she would become temporarily satisfied for about 3 minutes after she would, for example, purchase something.
Mm-hmm.
But then it would very quickly wear off. And I started to think, gosh, it's almost like all of us. Something good, so-called good, happens, and we feel a sense of happiness. And then that wears off, and then we're looking for the next thing to make us happy.
You talk about awakening to life, and I think your discussion or your statement about using a stopwatch every nine
yes.
minutes, bingo,
yes.
the alarm would go off, and you're going, oh, what am I doing with my mind?
Yes.
I really think that is significant. I loved your quote in here by Ram Dass, where he said, if you think you're so enlightened, go spend a week with your parents.
Right, and that's what...
oh, my goodness. Oh, boy.
And, in fact, for me, that was... not only was I working for Jeanette as a caregiver during the day, but before I got to the point where I moved in with her, I had moved back home. And I had 5 siblings, a grown son, my mother, my stepfather, my biological father, who was dying of cancer, and I thought, and nieces and nephews, so we had ages from newborn to 93, and there were so many, everybody had an opinion about something, and we were all mm-hmm. on the same property, and I thought, how is this possible? And of course, exactly, I was thinking I was doing pretty well until I started to notice with this stopwatch all of the secret thoughts of comparison, dislike, dismay, comparison. It was just chronic. And I knew, as a result of all of my paranormal experiences from lifelong, that all of the so-called spiritual sages and the spiritual teachers and all the texts, the spiritual texts notwithstanding, all pointed to this state of being where inner peace is one's constant state. And I thought, how on earth can a person in a regular life with a regular job and living in a regular family, how is it possible? So I decided that that was going to be my goal, that it couldn't get any harder than this. I had my family of origin all around me with all of these different cherished opinions, and then I had the woman that I was caring for, late-stage Alzheimer's, who was furious a great deal of the time, lashing out at me and everybody else. I thought, well, this is it. Either this is going to be my spiritual practice. And that's what I did. And I made it's true, I used courage and discipline, but I took it on in order to survive it. And I was fortunately able to do more than that. I was actually able to turn it into a way to find that state of inner peace all the time, no matter outer circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, a marvelous objective, because that is an enabler of an individual to handle challenges in life with clarity. When you don't have that kind of clarity, when you don't have that balance within yourself, you're going to go flip-flopping all over the place, become exhausted, maybe make irrational decisions, and God knows we've all done that at one time or another. So I really appreciated your book. Now, DPs is an abbreviation, for those of you listening, for difficult people. So whenever I say DP, you know it means difficult people. But you made a statement in your book saying, when you find yourself disapproving of someone, or even of yourself, meet your new guru. And you said also in your book that the source of life really does have a good sense of humor. And I would say that that is true if we're willing to be receptive to it, because so many times we look at things with a sense of darkness that takes away any opportunity for us to really look at a bigger picture. And that's a tough thing to do. It really, really is. Now, you say DPs actually need drama and conflict, and I would agree with you. Their lives just are not empowered unless they have drama and conflict on some level. And don't we all do that?
Yes, that's the point. That was exactly the point, is that everybody knows what it looks like to behold somebody with advanced dementia who's reacting at nothing. You know, the clouds come out and she's furious, or the sun's out and she's furious at that, or there's a bump in the road and she's furious at that. But the trouble with it is, normally when we have a difficult person in our life or a difficult problem in our life, we advise each other, you know, just kind of muddle through and make the best of it. We normally don't conceive of it as actually being our magical window to actually awaken spiritually to a significant degree, because usually we're trying to just cope. We're trying to deal. And it's true, it takes courage to be able to behold that which is difficult, particularly a difficult person, and to just, with courage and honesty, to be able to note how are those mental characteristics alive in me too? How do I do that too? And it was just uncanny to be able to find that I was doing the same thing, the exact same thing, perhaps to some lesser degree, and perhaps I wasn't doing it outwardly, but they were secret inner thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I decided to do something about it, of course it not only affected my position as her caregiver, not only was I able to do a much better job, so to speak, but it impacted her, and then it impacted me and all of the areas of my life, and everything changed and transformed, because, of course, the so-called energy around inner joy is much, much different than, say, the energy or vibration around inner despair or sadness or anger.
Mm-hmm. Very, very much so.
Just extraordinary how it just changed. Everything changed. Everything really changed from there. And as we proceeded on our journey together, I just was, there was not, you know, not a day went by where there was not another opportunity with, you know, she had to go on a feeding tube because she could no longer eat. And that just infuriated her. And she, of course, developed that mechanism of wandering, and she wanted to just leave, and I had to stop her. So there were so many opportunities for outrageous behavior that I had to not only take responsibility for, but also to be able to prevent myself from succumbing on a so-called stress level. For example, the Alzheimer's Association published some crazy statistic that says something like, I can't remember what the number is, but of spouse caregivers for Alzheimer's patients, there's some crazy number that a very significant number of spouse caregivers actually die within 3 years of the patient dying.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that? Because it's so stressful. So, of course, stress is not good for the physical body.
That is true.
Right. So it was about survival. And interestingly enough, Jeanette's husband and family were concerned about my well-being because I was working longer and longer hours. They wondered if they should take on a second person, but Jeanette didn't really, she was at the stage, as you can imagine, she didn't want anybody else in her house. And so I said, no, let me just move in and I will just do it all myself. I think with my spiritual practice, let me just try. So they were a little concerned about that. They didn't obviously want me to implode either or have some stressful reaction. But what I found out was it didn't matter eventually. Ultimately, it didn't matter what my body was doing. I could clean up throw up. I could clean up fecal matter. I could deal with somebody's rage. And if all is right in one's inner world, whatever is going on in the outer world really doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an extraordinary thing to experience.
I think there are those people that have come through wars and various situations that for many of us we'd consider very hideous, very ugly, that for their own peace of mind, that's exactly what they ended up doing. They would just say, this is the moment now. This is, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but it might be better tomorrow. So I'm just going to deal with what I can today. And just
right.
do what they can do. And I think that that kind of positioning is something for many people, especially if they are doers. They are saying, well, I'm going to go do. Well, sometimes you're in situations you have absolutely no control over what's going on.
Right. And that's also why both mental suffering and physical suffering produce such an opening, spiritually speaking. It's because we're forced to find out where our true nourishment lies, and it can only come from within. And the other aspect to the healing on my part was noticing that when Jeanette was suffering the most, it was when her mind was most active, when it was noisy and commenting. And so this whole thing about having a noisy mind where it's chronically chattering, that's really dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
And so then to find, okay, so then what is the antidote to that? Well, the antidote, of course, is to quiet the mind. Well, how do we do that? And anybody who practices yoga or meditation can tell you, sometimes even if one is successful within the hour of meditating, within the hour of yoga, but what about the practicality of the rest of the day? How does the mind quiet when you're in the grocery store, when you're in a rude somebody who's rude in front of you, or some difficult person is in your midst, or some difficult problem? And so there are very simple but effective spiritual practice that can elicit a quiet mind. And in that moment, of course, you can call it whatever you want, the life source or God or whatever you want to call it, but all of a sudden this beautiful moment of now shines through. And so what I did was I was able to find a way to quiet the mind. And it was first articulated by Eckhart Tolle, and by just using a few simple steps, such as putting one's attention on the deep breath. So one breathes in, and you let that breath take your attention to the inner energy field of the body. And when we feel that feeling, there's an amazing alignment with stillness that comes through.
What was the most profound aha that you experienced?
That every thought that we think is not true.
Wait. Every thought that we think is not true?
No, okay. But we believe that every thought that we think is true. And so thus, that means that not everything we think is true. It's a pretty startling recognition. And so what that means is, what then thoughts are true? Well, there's a very easy way to know. First of all, we have to agree that most people don't even agree that there's any question as to whether all thoughts are true or not, because we've placed such trust in the mind. And so if one is thinking something, unless, of course, one has a mental disorder like schizophrenia or something,
mm-hmm.
we assume that our thoughts are true and that we can count on them and trust them. Well, in fact, that's not the case. What happens is, through eons of evolution, the aspect of the analytical mind, and it's a term that Eckhart Tolle coined called the pain body, and it's a very dense emotional, energetic force field, if you will. It's almost like an entity in and of itself. But it's an aspect of the mind It's actually part of the egoic aspect, so it involves the ego, that has basically gotten out of control and has taken over the being, you. So most people assume that you are your mind, but it's not the case. So that inner essence, that wonderful animating life force, it's invisible, it's inside of us, and when it leaves, then the body dies. But while it's there, the body is alive. So it can't be the body, and it's not the mind. But when we confuse our mind with who we really are, is this wonderful animating life force, then we suffer. And the reason is because the pain body, or that emotional aspect of ourselves that feeds on drama and negativity, although most of us would deny that we actually need and want it, the truth of the matter is that it's a false part of ourselves that's taken us over, and we are now answering to it. So ideally, we use this aspect of our mind as a tool. We pick it up when we want to solve a problem, or when we want to put artistic expression into some form. But through eons of evolution, it has gotten out of control, and now we answer to it. So we have become the slave to it. And so that emotional pain body, that aspect of the ego that is always looking to find fault, it's always looking for a problem because it actually needs to feed on drama. It needs to feed on upset. And if there isn't any, then you just wait because it'll find something eventually. I'm sure most everybody knows somebody like that where everything's going great, there's not a problem in the world, and you might know somebody where they'll find it. Ah, you are now seeing the pain body in use. And it's basically impossible to have any lasting peace and harmony with anybody in your environment who has a very dense or very active pain body. So what's the antidote to it? Because that would really define the ultimate difficult person, such as the late-stage Alzheimer's patient, because they're chronically finding fault. If it's a perfect day, they'll find something wrong. Somewhere, somehow, there's a problem. And so because the problem is an active mind that is finding fault, and it's basically on a program of make wrong, then the antidote to it would be what? The antidote is to have no thought or quiet stillness. Now, most of us find that that's almost an impossible state to reach, but there's a very simple, effective spiritual practice when used with discipline one can learn to use that in a more expanded and expanded manner until we're able to quiet the mind for longer and longer periods. Now, this does not mean that we can't use the mind. We still can use it, but we pick it up like a tool, and then we put it back down. So thinking is interspersed with quiet. And then we become really effective in our lives. Then and only then is transformation really able to take place. And so what I determined and what I discovered from watching Jeanette, my patient who with late-stage Alzheimer's, is that she believed everything she thought. In a sentence, that characterized her brain disease. She believed, without a doubt, that if she left her purse in the restaurant, that I really stole it. So when I would run back and get it for her, noticing that she left it there, when I handed it to her, she'd say, you just tried to steal my purse. And of course, as we know, Alzheimer's can have characteristics of paranoia. So she believed her thought. Now, I realize that's an extreme example, but most of us have that same mechanism alive within us. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for a problem, but we deny that we are.
Boy, that's true. I think, and when I think of it, I think of my own personal experiences I've gone through, and I think so many times how I'll be in a situation. I'll give you an example. This happened to be just this past Sunday. I was at an event. I was doing an appearance there. And there was a gentleman that came up to talk to me, and his appearance was just the type of appearance that I would never, let's say, welcome.
Right.
He was dirty. He just looked terrible, and I thought, okay, no judgment here. Let's just see what this person has to say. As it turned out,
I find out this guy is a scientist, you know, he's quite intelligent, and we end up having this marvelous conversation.
Right.
But that is an example. I'll use me as an example, how the mind will make certain statements. And part of that is because maybe past experiences we've had or things that we've been indoctrinated with. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be on guard. You shouldn't be alert and aware. You should. But I wasn't in a dangerous situation. I was not in a negative environment like a back alley at 3 a.m. in the morning where there's no lights and somebody could have a gun on them. That wasn't where I was. But even if it had been that place, it is how do you discern things? And this person is very intelligent, has a wonderful conversation, and I thought, boy, wouldn't I have missed out on something if I would have left the original judgment in place?
Right. Now take that mechanism and live with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So meaning, why, of course, marriages can't work. Of course, relationships are fraught with suffering. Because every single one of us has this alive within us, and so we're doing it to each other. So lasting harmony is impossible. So what we say is, well, a good marriage takes a lot of work. But when one quiets the mind, arguing is impossible. As one starts to awaken spiritually because their mind is becoming more quiet, and what goes along with that? Well, a more peaceful way of being because there's less secret judgment. It's actually impossible to have an argument. What's there to argue about? So as I saw Jeanette's life imploding with all this mental suffering, in the same context, by the way, that she was really lacking for nothing. I mean, it's true that she had this diagnosis, but when I first came on board, she was relatively high-functioning. She just had some issues with her memory.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't matter. She was as miserable then as she was, right up into her last days. So the mind runs havoc in our lives, and we've just gotten to the point where we don't suspect that the mind has anything to do with our trauma and our suffering, but it has everything to do with it. But we've been so tricked into believing the wonders of the mind, and we haven't noticed that through eons of evolution, it has taken us over, and we are slaves to it. So now that we know what the problem is, it's very easy to apply an antidote. And the antidote is to quiet the mind and allow stillness to arise, because underneath the mind there is always stillness. It's just obscured and covered up by chronic mental chatter. And people who talk a lot, you'll notice sometimes, if you think of somebody who's a chronic talker, you might notice that that's one person who might be very difficult to be around, because characteristic of constant chattering is a constant chattering mind. And somebody who's has a very, very constant, noisy mind usually creates suffering for themselves and others.
Fascinating. I think we all can relate to that on one level or another. And I think many times I've noticed that when people are those constant chatterers, they're just going, they're also people that are very fearful. Very, very fearful, and they cannot be good listeners. They don't know how.
Yes, the characteristic of a noisy mind, of course, because it's living in the past and because it's living in the future, it does so because it has a basic emotion of fear at its base. It's constantly trying to hedge off whatever, fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. So yes, that's true. It's a very fearful countenance. In fact, Jeanette, with her Alzheimer's, yes, underlying fury and anger is fear. Fear that something's going to be taken from her, fear that she's going to lose something, fear that she's not the most beautiful in the room, fear that she's losing her looks. These are all very normal aspects of a very strong ego.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, we've sometimes are more familiar with the term narcissist. And it just explains and describes that aspect of the mind that is alive within every single one of us, varying only by degree, and when we can quiet in it, then our beautiful essence shines through. And that essence is always there. It's just been covered up and obscured by mental noise. And so
Go ahead.
So that was the antidote to caring for somebody with Alzheimer's, and of course, ultimately, caring for myself.
You have a comment in your book. It says, even when it appears that your partner or family member is not interested in growing spiritually by your example, they cannot help but grow and expand along with you. That brought to mind a story about Gandhi's wife, and her name is escaping my mind just at this moment, but I was so amazed when I found out that she was the woman that taught him about peacefulness, about the very thing you're describing, because he had been trained as an attorney, had a very quick mind, and when he had been over in London and he came home and he had left his wife and his children and was over there doing what he was doing. So when he came home, he tried to dominate everything. Well, of course, they were living in their mother-in-law's home, which is traditional in India in many ways. And he starts dictating orders. And she was just very quiet, very thoughtful. And he found she wasn't listening to him. She wasn't doing what he was telling her to do. And so one day, his big aha came when he was saying, this is what you need to do, and this is what you need to do. And it was very, very critical. And she looked at him. She said, well, if you like, I can go to your mother and tell her what you think we should do in the way of change. How do you think she will respond to that? And she was very quiet when she said it. And he just suddenly was sort of pulled up mentally by his bootstraps. And he realized that he wasn't going to win in any way, shape, or form. And he was being very arrogant. And actually very, very rude. And he said his wife taught him the passiveness of non-resistance, getting things done. And, of course, he lived his life in that demonstration in so many ways, and it was always a challenge for him. But it was his wife that taught him that.
Beautiful.
And when I read that portion in your book, that was so profound for me. And I just said, this is what she did. Gracious lady, and the book is called The Forgotten Woman, and her grandson wrote her story, and she was an amazing, amazing woman. But I wanted to share that with you because you also say in your book, when one becomes more practiced in refusing to engage, and I'll use your word, another's pain body, you'll notice that the force behind both pain bodies lessens rather than strengthens. So it's like feeding a wild creature,
yes,
the wild creature of the disordered mind. And when you feed it by giving in to it, by not recognizing what's going on, then things get agitated. If you understand what's going on, then you are able to say, no, this isn't the appropriate way to do it. And that doesn't mean that you're running from something. I think that's something people need to understand. This doesn't mean you're a coward. It doesn't mean that you are not taking care of responsibilities. It means that you have a control of yourself in the response patterning. And I think that it's a very powerful lesson, and I don't think it's an easy one to learn.
Yes, it's this idea that this aspect of the mind that needs to feed on negativity and actually needs drama, though it denies it at every turn, it actually holds, like a savings account, our most potent life force. When we feed it, we strengthen it, and it keeps taking our own life force for its own use. And when that happens, it can affect our physical health and certainly our overall well-being. So then, in the opposite case, when we refuse to strengthen it by refusing to be pulled into drama, no matter what, we reclaim that life force for our own use. And if a person were to practice this for 1 year, just by placing their attention on what they're thinking and by being more conscious of not being pulled into drama, in about a year you can completely transform your life, because you're reclaiming all that life force that has been used by your own analytical mind or the pain body, whichever word you want to use. And now it's available for use by you. And so one has much more clarity. One is able to be much more creative and know the right timing for themselves and for their life. And that's a huge thing, to know right timing and to have a sense for their own soul's purpose and for how they should best conduct the days and the years of their own lives. And so it's not about finding the perfect partner, because so many women are on the spiritual path, and of course men too. But as spiritual practitioners, the person who conceives of themselves as being on the spiritual path, often they find themselves in a relationship with somebody who they say is not. And so they struggle with, well, should I leave this person because they're holding me back? Well, guess what? It doesn't matter. Forget their path. Reclaim your own essence. Watch your own life transform, and then theirs will too. Now, interestingly enough, because pain bodies must match in vibration, we always find a matching pain body. That's just the way that it works, because like attracts like energies. So when you're with somebody and your pain bodies are matching in vibration, as you then reclaim your own lost essence, they will either change or that they will leave. Because it's intolerable for an active pain body, a very dense pain body, to be around harmony. It's actually completely intolerable. And they'll get more sophisticated, trying to find a way to pull you in. And as you continue to use your own spiritual practice and just notice that, oh, look at that. Okay, he's going to be more cunning than ever to try to draw me in. But you'll see that there'll be a transformation. Mystically, one party will leave the other, or mystically, the other party will change.
Lisette, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for being my guest today. Your book, Difficult People, A Gateway to Enlightenment, Lisette Larkins is my guest. Lisette, you have so much wisdom that's in your book. There's so much good information. And I want people to know that they can go to your website, lisettelarkins.com. That's LISETTELARKINS. Wow, it's a big aha that I think can benefit just about anyone. I welcome you to check it out. And Lisette, again, thank you for being my guest.
Thank you, Donna.
It's been a wonderful show. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Siebel. We'll be back here tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.